The shape of fear. Name equals link fear I.D. equals link fear. The shape of fear. Tim O'Connor, who was descended from the O'Connors with one N, started life as a poet and an enthusiast. His mother had designed him for the priesthood, and at the age of 15, most of his verses had an ecclesiastical tinge, but, somehow or other, he got into the newspaper business instead, and became a pessimistic gentleman, with a literary style of great beauty and an income of modest proportions. He fell in with men who talked of art for art's sake, though what right they had to speak of art at all nobody knew, and little by little his view of life and love became more or less profane. He met a woman who sucked his heart's blood, and he knew it and made no protest. Nay, to the great amusement of the fellows who talked of art for art's sake, he went the length of marrying her. He could not in decency explain that he had the traditions of fine gentlemen behind him and so had to do as he did, because his friends might not have understood. He laughed at the days when he had thought of the priesthood, blushed when he ran across any of those tender and exquisite old verses he had written in his youth, and became addicted to absinthe and other less peculiar drinks, and to gaming a little to escape a madness of ennui. As the years went by he avoided, with more and more scorn, that part of the world which he denominated Philistine, and consorted only with the fellows who flocked about Jim O'Malley's saloon. He was pleased with solitude, or with these convivial wits, and with not very much else beside. Jim O'Malley was a sort of Irish poem, set to inspiring measure. He was, in fact, a Hibernian Maecenas, who knew better than to put bad whiskey before a man of talent, or tell a trite tale in the presence of a wit. The recountal of his disquisitions on politics and other current matters had enabled no less than three men to acquire national reputations, and a number of wretches, having gone the way of men who talk of art for art's sake, and dying in foreign lands, or hospitals, or asylums, having no one else to be homesick for, had been homesick for Jim O'Malley, and wept for the sound of his voice and the grasp of his hearty hand. When Tim O'Connor turned his back upon most of the things he was born to and took up with the life which he consistently lived till the unspeakable end, he was unable to get rid of certain peculiarities. For example, in spite of all his debauchery, he continued to look like the beloved apostle. Notwithstanding abject friendships he wrote limpid and noble English. Purity seemed to dog his heels, no matter how violently he attempted to escape from her. He was never so drunk that he was not an exquisite, and even his creditors, who had become inured to his deceptions, confessed it was a privilege to meet so perfect a gentleman. The creature who held him in bondage, body and soul, actually came to love him for his gentleness, and for some quality which baffled her, and made her ache with a strange longing which she could not define. Not that she ever defined anything, poor little beast. She had skin the color of pale gold, and yellow eyes with brown lights in them, and great plaits of straw-colored hair. About her lips was a fatal and sensuous smile, which, when it got hold of a man's imagination, would not let it go, but held to it, and mocked it till the day of his death. She was the incarnation of the eternal feminine. With all the wifeliness and the maternity left out, she was ancient, yet ever young, and familiar as joy or tears or sin. She took good care of Tim in some ways, fed him well, nursed him back to reason after a period of hard drinking, saw that he put on overshoes when the walks were wet, and looked after his money. She even prized his brain, for she discovered that it was a delicate little machine which produced gold. By association with him and his friends, she learned that a number of apparently useless things had value in the eyes of certain convenient fools, and so she treasured the autographs of distinguished persons who wrote to him, autographs which he disdainfully tossed in the waste basket. She was careful with presentation copies from authors, and she went the length of urging Tim to write a book himself. But at that he balked. "Write a book," he cried to her, his gentle face suddenly white with passion. "Who am I to commit such a profanation?" She didn't know what he meant, but she had a theory that it was dangerous to excite him, and so she sat up till midnight to cook a chop for him when he came home that night. He preferred to have her sitting up for him, and he wanted every electric light in their apartments turned to the full. If, by any chance, they returned together to a dark house, he would not enter till she touched the button in the hall, and illuminated the room. Or if it so happened that the lights were turned off in the night time, and he awoke to find himself in darkness, he shrieked till the woman came running to his relief, and, with derisive laughter, turned them on again. But when she found that after these frights he lay trembling and white in his bed, she began to be alarmed for the clever, gold-making little machine, and to renew her assiduities, and to hoard more tenaciously than ever, those valuable curios on which she someday expected to realize when he was out of the way, and no longer in a position to object to their barter. O'Connor's idiosyncrasy of fear was a source of much amusement among the boys at the office where he worked. They made open sport of it, and yet, Recognizing him for a sensitive plant, and granting that genius was entitled to whimsicalities, it was their custom when they called for him after work hours, to permit him to reach the lighted corridor before they turned out the gas over his desk. This, they reasoned, was but a slight service to perform for the most enchanting beggar in the world. "Dear fellow," said Rick Dodson, who loved him, "is it the devil you expect to see? And if so, why are you averse? Surely the devil is not such a bad old chap. You haven't found him so? Tim, by heaven, you know, you ought to explain to me. A citizen of the world and a student of its purlieus, like myself, ought to know what there is to know. Now you're a man of sense, in spite of a few bad habits, such as myself, for example. Is this fad of yours madness? Which would be quite to your credit, for gadzooks, I like a lunatic. Or is it the complaint of a man who has gathered too much data on the subject of old rye? Or is it, as I suspect, something more occult, and therefore more interesting?" "Rick, boy," said Tim, "you're too inquiring." And he turned to his desk with a look of delicate hauteur. It was the very next night that these two tippling pessimists spent together talking about certain disgruntled but immortal gentlemen, who, having said their say and made the world quite uncomfortable, had now journeyed on to inquire into the nothingness which they postulated. The dawn was breaking in the muggy east, the bottles were empty, the cigars burned out. Tim turned toward his friend with a sharp breaking of sociable silence. "Rick," he said, "do you know that fear has a shape? And so has my nose. You asked me the other night what I feared. Holy Father, I make my confession to you. What I fear is fear. That's because you've drunk too much, or not enough. Come, fill the cup, and in the fire of spring your winter garment of repentance fling. My costume then would be too nebulous for this weather, dear boy. But it's true what I was saying. I'm afraid of ghosts. For an agnostic that seems a bit. Agnostic. Yes, so completely an agnostic that I do not even know that I do not know. God, man, do you mean you have no ghosts, no things which shape themselves? Why, there are things I have done. Don't think of them, my boy. See, night's candles are burned out, and jocund day stands tiptoe on the misty mountain top." Tim looked about him with a sickly smile. He looked behind him and there was nothing there, stared at the blank window, where the smoky dawn showed its offensive face, and there was nothing there. He pushed away the moist hair from his haggard face, that face which would look like the blessed Saint John, and leaned heavily back in his chair. "Yon light is not daylight, I know it, aye," he murmured drowsily, "it is some meteor which the sun exhales, to be to thee this night." The words floated off in languid nothingness, and he slept. Dodson arose preparatory to stretching himself on his couch. But first he bent over his friend with a sense of tragic appreciation. "Damned by the skin of his teeth," he muttered. "A little more, and he would have gone right, and the devil would have lost a good fellow." As it is, he smiled with his usual conceited delight in his own sayings, even when they were uttered in soliloquy, "He is merely one of those splendid gentlemen one will meet with in hell." Then Dodson had a momentary nostalgia for goodness himself, but he soon overcame it, and stretching himself on his sofa, he, too, slept. That night he and O'Connor went together to hear Faust sung, and returning to the office, Dodson prepared to write his criticism. Except for the distant clatter of telegraph instruments, or the peremptory cries of copy from an upper room, the office was still. Dodson wrote and smoked his interminable cigarettes, O'Connor rested his head and his hands on the desk, and sat in perfect silence. He did not know when Dodson finished, or when, arising, and absent-mindedly extinguishing the lights, he moved to the door with his copy in his hands. Dodson gathered up the hats and coats as he passed them where they lay on a chair, and called. "It is done, Tim. Come, let's get out of this." There was no answer, and he thought Tim was following, but after he had handed his criticism to the city editor, he saw he was still alone, and returned to the room for his friend. He advanced no further than the doorway, for, as he stood in the dusky corridor and looked within the darkened room, he saw before his friend a shape, white, of perfect loveliness, divinely delicate and pure and ethereal, which seemed as the embodiment of all goodness. From it came a soft radiance and a perfume softer than the wind when it breathes upon a bank of violets stealing and giving odor. Staring at it, with eyes immovable, sat his friend. It was strange that at sight of a thing so unspeakably fair, a coldness like that which comes from the jewel-blue lips of a mere crevasse should have fallen upon Dodson, or that it was only by summoning all the manhood that was left in him, that he was able to restore light to the room, and to rush to his friend. When he reached poor Tim he was stone still with paralysis. They took him home to the woman, who nursed him out of that attack, and later on worried him into another. When he was able to sit up and jeer at things a little again, and help himself to the quail the woman broiled for him, Dodson, sitting beside him, said, "Did you call that little exhibition of yours legerdemain, Tim, you sweep? Or are you really the devil's bairn?" "It was the shape of fear," said Tim, quite seriously. "But it seemed mild as mother's milk. It was compounded of the good I might have done. It is that which I fear." He would explain no more. Later, many months later, he died patiently and sweetly in the madhouse, praying for rest. The little beast with the yellow eyes had high mass celebrated for him, which, all things considered, was almost as pathetic as it was amusing. Dodson was in Vienna when he heard of it. "Sir, sir," cried he. "I wish it wasn't so dark in the tomb. What do you suppose Tim is looking at?" As for Jim O'Malley, he was with difficulty kept from illuminating the grave with electricity on the northern ice. The winter nights up at Sault Ste. Marie are as wide and luminous as the Milky Way. The silence which rests upon the solitude appears to be wide also. Even sound has been included in nature's arrestment, for, indeed, save the still white frost, all things seem to be obliterated. The stars have a poignant brightness, but they belong to heaven and not to earth, and between their immeasurable height and the still ice rolls the ebon ether in vast, liquid billows. In such a place it is difficult to believe that the world is actually peopled. It seems as if it might be the dark of the day after Cain killed Abel, and as if all of humanity's remainder was huddled in affright away from the awful spaciousness of creation. The night Ralph Hagedorn started out for Echo Bay, bent on a pleasant duty, he laughed to himself, and said that he did not at all object to being the only man in the world, so long as the world remained as unspeakably beautiful as it was when he buckled on his skates and shot away into the solitude. He was bent on reaching his best friend in time to act as groomsman, and business had delayed him till time was at its briefest. So he journeyed by night and journeyed alone, and when the tang of the frost got at his blood, he felt as a spirited horse feels when it gets free of bit and bridle. The ice was as glass, his skates were keen, his frame fit, and his venture to his taste. So he laughed, and cut through the air as a sharp stone cleaves the water. He could hear the whistling of the air as he cleft it. As he went on and on in the black stillness, he began to have fancies. He imagined himself enormously tall, a great Viking of the Northland, hastening over icy fjords to his love. And that reminded him that he had a love, though, indeed, that thought was always present with him as a background for other thoughts. To be sure, he had not told her that she was his love, for he had seen her only a few times, and the auspicious occasion had not yet presented itself. She lived at Echo Bay also, and was to be the maid of honor to his friend's bride, which was one more reason why he skated almost as swiftly as the wind, and why, now and then, he let out a shout of exultation. The one cloud that crossed Hagedorn's sun of expectancy was the knowledge that Marie Beaujeu's father had money, and that Marie lived in a house with two stories to it, and wore otter skin about her throat and little satin-lined mink boots on her feet when she went sledding. Moreover, in the locket in which she treasured a bit of her dead mother's hair, there was a black pearl as big as a pea. These things made it difficult, perhaps impossible, for Ralph Hagedorn to say more than, "I love you." But that much he meant to say, though he were scourged with chagrin for his temerity. This determination grew upon him as he swept along the ice under the starlight. Venus made a glowing path toward the west and seemed eager to reassure him. He was sorry he could not skim down that avenue of light which flowed from the love star, but he was forced to turn his back upon it and face the black northeast. It came to him with a shock that he was not alone. His eyelashes were frosted and his eyeballs blurred with the cold, so at first he thought it might be an illusion. But when he had rubbed his eyes hard, he made sure that not very far in front of him was a long white skater in fluttering garments who sped over the ice as fast as ever werewolf went. He called aloud, but there was no answer. He shaped his hands and trumpeted through them, but the silence was as before, it was complete. So then he gave chase, setting his teeth hard and putting attention on his firm young muscles. But go however he would, the white skater went faster. After a time, as he glanced at the cold gleam of the North Star, he perceived that he was being led from his direct path. For a moment he hesitated, wondering if he would not better keep to his road, but his weird companion seemed to draw him on irresistibly, and finding it sweet to follow, he followed. Of course it came to him more than once in that strange pursuit, that the white skater was no earthly guide. Up in those latitudes men see curious things when the hoarfrost is on the earth. Hagedorn's own father, to hark no further than that for an instance, who lived up there with the Lake Superior Indians, and worked in the copper mines, had welcomed a woman at his hut one bitter night, who was gone by morning, leaving wolf tracks on the snow. Yes, it was so, and John Fontenelle, the half-breed, could tell you about it any day, if he were alive. Alack, the snow where the wolf tracks were, is melted now. Well, Hagadorn followed the white skater all the night, and when the ice flushed pink at dawn, and arrows of lovely light shot up into the cold heavens, she was gone, and Hagadorn was at his destination. The sun climbed arrogantly up to his place above all other things, and as Hagadorn took off his skates and glanced carelessly lakeward, he beheld a great wind rift in the ice, and the waves showing blue and hungry between white fields. Had he rushed along his intended path, watching the stars to guide him, his glance turned upward, all his body at magnificent momentum, he must certainly have gone into that cold grave. How wonderful that it had been sweet to follow the white skater, and that he followed. His heart beat hard as he hurried to his friend's house. But he encountered no wedding furor. His friend met him as men meet in houses of mourning. "Is this your wedding face?" cried Hagadorn. "Why, man, starved as I am, I look more like a bridegroom than you. There's no wedding today." "No wedding? Why, you're not. Marie Beaujeu died last night."
"Marie?
Died last night?" She had been skating in the afternoon, and she came home chilled and wandering in her mind, as if the frost had gutted it somehow. She grew worse and worse, and all the time she talked of you.
"Of me?"
"We wondered what it meant. No one knew you were lovers."
"I didn't know it myself, more's the pity. At least, I didn't know.
She said you were on the ice, and that you didn't know about the big breaking up, and she cried to us that the wind was offshore and the rift widening. She cried over and over again that you could come in by the old French creek if you only knew.
I came in that way."
"But how did you come to do that?
It's out of the path.
We thought perhaps." But Hagadorn broke in with his story and told him all as it had come to pass. That day they watched beside the maiden, who lay with tapers at her head and at her feet, and in the little church the bride who might have been at her wedding said prayers for her friend. They buried Marie Beaujeu in her bridesmaid white, and Hagadorn was before the altar with her, as he had intended from the first. Then at midnight the lovers who were to wed whispered their vows in the gloom of the cold church, and walked together through the snow to lay their bridal wreaths upon a grave. 3 nights later, Hagadorn skated back again to his home. They wanted him to go by